Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is William Haywood Henderson, who reads from and discusses his acclaimed novel, Augusta Locke, published by Viking. In the weeks to come, we have John Perkins, Rick Riley, Nando Parado, Augustine Burroughs, Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Strout, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. William Haywood Henderson was born in Syracuse, New York, but quickly migrated west. He grew up mostly in Colorado, headed farther west for college, and earned a BA in English from the University of California at Berkeley. He held a variety of jobs before heading back east to take a degree in creative writing at Brown University. He attended Stanford University as a Wallace Stegner Fellow in Creative Writing, and he used that time to finish his first novel, Native, and start his second novel, The Rest of the Earth. He has taught creative writing at Brown, Harvard, and the University of Colorado at Denver, and since 2002, he has also taught novel writing at Lighthouse Writers Workshop. Woo! I see some fellow faculty members and alumni are in the audience tonight, and welcome to you all. We're delighted to welcome Bill Henderson back to the Tattered Cover. Would you please join me in congratulating him on the publication of his newest novel, Augusta Locke?
Thank you, Charles. Thank you all for coming. I think what I'm going to do is read a little bit of this book that I found upstairs, and then I'll open it up if you have any questions to ask, if that's okay. I don't know if any of you have looked at the book yet. It's a story of a young woman who at age 14 finds herself with a young child. I guess she's 15 when she actually has a child, and has to make her way in a man's world in Wyoming. She works a lot of men's jobs. She works road crew. She works for a bootlegger. Mostly it's a story of her and her child between the years of about 1917 and 1935. So I'm going to read something from her earlier life. This is actually the day that she meets the man who will be the father of her child. And let me think if you need to know anything. Her mother's name is Leota. Her mother's new husband's name is Frank. And her name is Gussie Locke. Gussie was nearly 15 years old the day she met Jack Fisher, a Sunday in May 1917, Greeley. She sat square in the corner of the back seat of an automobile, dust settling on her white lap and the black leather seat. It was a slow drive from the wheat fields toward the green trees beyond along the river. Behind, dust muddied the sunrise. Gussie watched the sun reflected in the windows, watched her mother, Leota, and her mother's new husband, Frank Locke, watched Leota's exquisite neck and Frank's jaw with its stubble scraped beneath the red surface and the muscles tensing. Gussie would be baptized with his surname today, Augusta Locke. Frank's jacket was sleek black, iridescent, the fine early colors of the day reflected deep within. His collar cut a white crease across his meaty neck. The automobile passed in through a gate. Far ahead, automobiles and wagons lined the edge of cottonwoods, and the mountains took the horizon high into blue, with Long's Peak, like a dream of a white pyramid. But before dawn that morning, Gussie had woken to the sound of her mother's approach, looked toward the door. Leota entered the room, perched on the edge of the bed, pulled Gussie from beneath the blankets and sat her up. She held Gussie's face in her hands, studied her, leaned close, released her. "I finished the dress. I showed it to Frank. You'll be fine." When Leota had first come home with a bolt of linen, she'd said, "You'll be layered in white, Gussie. Brilliant. I'm capable of delicate stitches. Always have been." And she'd told Gussie of her own childhood in Duluth, before the years in Ravenglass, of her own fine dresses, the tightness of the bodice that had made her feel upright, the flow of the skirts that had caught around her progress and slowed her. She had rambled on about her childhood lately, new stories of boys and gentlemen courting, kindnesses, attentions. Somewhere below, Frank moved through the house, out into the chill darkness, looking for the farm manager, asking after the kind of minor assignment that might convince a man like himself, a banker, a gentleman farmer, that he is the soul of his acres, that he hears the bubbling of the aquifer far below, that he can cock his head like a robin and hear the seeds germinate and push toward the sun. This morning, for a few minutes, he might oil the gears of a planter, sort nails into cans. Leota led Gussie down the hall to the front bedroom. Frank's scent was still damp on the air, tobacco, pomade. She sat the girl on the edge of the high iron bed on the wedding ring quilt, the pattern of interlocking blue rings. Leota sat beside Gussie, handed her a small silver dish, the usual routine, and Gussie held the dish on her lap. With a brush, Leota pulled through Gussie's tangles, extracted scraps of leaf, dry tendril, insect wing. She dropped the takings into the silver dish, and Gussie fingered through them, pinched a section of beetle carapace, inspected the dull horns and crenulations of the armor, tested its lightness, so airy that it might have been no more than a hollow black reflection. Leota secured Gussie's hair with ribbons and mother-of-pearl combs. Leota dressed Gussie in white drawers in a muslin shift, brought from the closet the linen dress gleaming from the iron. "Let's slip this on and see what we've got." Gussie looked at her mother's fragile smile, raised her arms and took on the cold white linen, felt the tight fit about her shoulders. She shrugged and the dress rustled. The cuffs tugged at her wrists. Reaching down, she took hold of the hem, raised the skirt up and inspected the fabric. Tiny pale violets scattered wide. Gussie tried to see the structure of the flowers, but the stamens were no more than a loop of thread, and the petals no more than three loops each. Leota stepped back. "You're my sweetheart," she said. "You're my dear little girl." "Not hardly." "You are today, especially. Look at you, just plain beautiful." Gussie stood there in the new dress, weeks of Leota's planning and work. She could step from the outfit and run. She could drop the ribbons and go wild, but she held still and displayed herself. Leota nodded and clicked her tongue, pressed softly at Gussie's back and urged her toward the mirror. In the lamplight, with the window just starting to go silver, she saw her shape in the looking-glass, the scowl of her features, and her hair an uncertain color, pure black on the surface, but woven with shadows of red, hints of gold and ruined blonde. Leota brought the light closer, tilted the mirror for a more perfect image. Gussie studied Leota's handiwork, the collar a soft scallop. Leota helped her on with the narrow boots, tugged at the skirts to settle the flow. The tiny violets floated like early spring in a snowfield. Gussie could not remember ever being this well set. She inhaled deeply and judged the garment's bind. It strapped her, tugged at her flat breasts, forced her to follow the seams, the elegant lines, not altogether unpleasant. She held herself as still and steady as possible, inched toward the bed, sat and waited for Leota to ready herself, waited to see where this dress might take her. Leota removed her nightgown. She was a small woman, the structure of her bones like wire and gossamer, her spine a faint line of shadow. Leota's dark blue dress covered her soft skin, the tracery of her veins. She took Gussie's hand and raised her from the bed. "Let's go. We'll find your father, your husband. We'll find Frank." Gussie shadowed Leota through the halls of that tall house, a house without years enough for shade trees. All her life, Gussie had watched Leota walk ahead, watched how her steps always seemed to find the high ground, stir no dust, how she kept her hands planted forward at her hips, as if she had no need for balance. They came to the top of the stairs, their hands on the banister, paused at the sound of the automobile approaching from the barn. A deep backfire rolled across the fields, pure distance in every direction. Slowly down the stairs, Gussie held her skirts free from her steps. She and Leota paused again when the automobile stopped outside the front door. The engine cut off. Frank came in through the door, didn't look up to see them there, said loudly, "Leota, I'm ready when you're ready." He kept moving toward his study, saying, "Could have done this ceremony private." With the latch of the door, he shut himself in. Leota glanced back up at Gussie. "We don't want to be late, do we? Can't keep God waiting. I'd like to be on his good side." She kept on down the stairs, a smooth glide, reached the floor, turned toward the kitchen. "Just a quick bite before we go. How does that sound?" Step after step, descending, Gussie attempted Leota's glide. Somehow it seemed that the effort it took to hold herself erect and keep her skirts clear and count out an even tempo without looking down at her footfalls and slide her hand along the banister with her wrist at a loose ankle and her fingers splayed. Somehow it seemed that that effort overwhelmed her other senses, that she could hear nothing but a warm hiss only vaguely disturbed by actual sound, could see nothing but a light that refracted just above the surface of objects, could think of nothing but her feet tight in the slick-soled boots and her chest restrained. She alighted and turned, following Leota. If this was the effect of beautiful clothes and straight posture, then perhaps Leota never really saw this house with its dark wood, never really heard the empty afternoons or saw the meadowlarks on the fence posts. To Leota, a bird might be no more than another tumbling scrap of glass in a kaleidoscope, another lovely shape reflecting itself through the days and weeks. For this single minute, as she made her way in Leota's wake, Gussie felt that she might understand the comfort of beauty. And now I think I will read something a little bit later. It's actually... Can you hear me okay? Now I'm going to read a dream. There are just a couple of dreams in the book, but this is shortly after Gussie has run away from home, which happens shortly after what I just read. And she's heading north toward Wyoming, sleeping along a river near Virginia Dale, which is on that road from Fort Collins to Laramie. And this is a dream she has. Her grandfather's name is Einar. Her father's name is Brud. She grew up in the North Woods, north of Lake Superior. I think that's all you need to know. She dreamed. She held a square of parchment, unfolded it, and there, on the crisp yellow surface, secured with a black ribbon, she found the shock of her grandfather Einar's silver hair. This was all she had of him. He'd died before Brud found Leota. Gussie ran that soft silver across her cheeks, across her closed eyes, held it to her lips, and inhaled. Far north in the spruce forest, she came to Einar. He was walled in by heavy boughs and darkness, old cedar and cold. A flame burned in a cup of rock. Smoke obscured the light, but still she could see Brud in Einar's features, Brud as he might appear in 40 years, old and alone and banished from the center of life, and yet still full of anticipation and desire, full of his own maps of the world. Einar reached for her through the smoke, pulled her to sit beside him, his rough skin icy, and together they held their hands to the warmth. "Where am I headed," she asked, "that I've looped all the way back to you?" For she knew vaguely that she was far from where she was supposed to be on the Laramie Road near Virginia Dale. "I can't know where you're headed," Einar said. "This is all I can say for sure. If you know where you're headed, then turn left at the Black Spruce. If you don't know where you're headed, then turn right. There's fast running water in both directions, good for drinking. There are turns you might take if you see something that catches your fancy. I remember finding what was left of an Ojibwa lodge, just the ribs with all the covering gone. huge, the wind whistling through the structure, and I stood inside and tried to hear the old voices. I remember coming to the brink of a village and hearing the sounds swirling with the evening smoke and trying to separate the human voices from the voices of machinery and wind and animal. And I waited until night filled in among the trees, the night sky and stars falling and settling against the windows. And then there were no voices at all, and I entered the maze of the village. I didn't know where to start, and I didn't know where the village ended. Gussie looked at Einar squarely, looked at the firelight giving out to the enormous, cold, starry sky. "Look at me," she said. Einar took the girl's chin in a tight pinch, leaned to her, studied her, placed his lips quickly to her lips, and she felt the parchment of his skin. "Here's what I know," he said to her, his grandchild he would never meet. "You awake on a cold morning in late fall to find your breath has beaded moisture on the fallen leaves, drops of water tainted with your blood, your heat, from deep inside you. You're constantly leaving your traces. You move on. You follow raven calls. You listen to the skeleton trees rattle their bones. And once in a great while, you see yourself in a sheet of morning ice, alone, and you're startled. You're sure you're a stranger, sure you aren't human, just a creature, breathing, unlike any other." "What am I?" she asked. "What creature?" "Dark, smart, like your grandmother." "Who was she? Who was my grandmother? I don't know her name. I don't know her face." He looked at her a long while. Then he grabbed a pile of fuel and dropped it on the fire. A cloud of sparks rose among the boughs, the red challenging the stars, cooling into the void, and she was alone. She thought that the forest had fallen away, thought she walked across open fields, but then the moon swung up, and the surface of the forest far below her feet shone silver and dark, and she saw the trees as nothing but a mat, branching and holding low in the sway of gravity, earthbound. Across the country, the creeks and waterways gleamed with the cold, pure moonlight, as if the globe shone from within with its own light, mapping its valleys and declines. She closed her eyes and saw that map imprinted at the back of her eyes, and she opened her eyes, and the sun had risen hot and stark. She was up against the heat, looking far down to the long, curving shore of Superior and the forests marching north into their own green haze, broken by the beautiful dark pools and the reflected sky that made the pools appear immensely deep and thin-surfaced. She drifted on north, and still she found the map of that country sharp at the back of her eyes. And then she saw rising from the forest a swirling cloud of smoke, but the smoke fragmented and grew darker until she saw that it was a large flock of ravens, nearly 100, riding an updraft from their roosts in the canopy, from their grips on the cold, hard wood, free now in the day's warm currents. On they came until she heard their voices, their rolling calls. The ravens swept up around her and past her, and she was caught in their momentum, effortless, rising another 1,000 feet. She heard the males call to the females, and the females reply with the joy of altitude and heat, and she knew, although she didn't know how, which were the females and which were the males. They all were black and large and strong, but to her they were distinct. The females looked to the males to start the dive. The females turned their black eyes from the stark sun. The females thought of how, when they landed, they would beg for a scrap of food and squawk with their bills wide, but for now they were strong with the males. The males spoke of speed and cached meat. The males turned their black eyes to the females. The males thought of how they would strut the ground and fluff their feathers and flash the white membranes of their eyes later, but for now they swirled with the females in the high places where the clouds floated. They drifted, they paired and split. They fell, and Gussie fell with them. They tipped a wing and rolled to their backs. They tipped the other wing and rolled upright. The wind of their descent fingered through their feathers and tightened their skin. They rolled and rolled again. They called and called in harsh and beautiful codas, and Gussie heard the notes and understood. They sang of the long fall down the rays of the sun, of the tall air free now of cloud and eagle, of the sleek speed of their weight, of days and nights and the scattering of the horizons and the cliffs cold with rain, and the lonely groves where thousands roost. She felt the air and the songs around her. She felt each black feather anchored in the glorious, strange stretch of her skin. She felt the whistle of her nostrils and the sharp danger of her bill. She felt the grip and flex of her talons. She felt the whole weight of the earth drawn up at her with incredible speed, and she wondered at her power to attract the earth so violently, and wondered at her fearless snap of wings and tail as the ravens caught the merest layer of air above the treetops and broke off each to his own direction. She chose north. That's what's going to be. That's all I'm going to read. Does anyone have any questions? I would say it's lyrical and dense. People might call it poetic. It's not spare. I'm most influenced by, Walt Whitman, Cormac McCarthy, because he can get kind of rich every now and then. Faulkner. Does that answer your question? I think I use landscape in a similar way. Are you all familiar with Cormac McCarthy? All the Pretty Horses, the Crossing, Cities of the Plain, Sutri. Yes. I use landscape a lot. It's of great interest to me. And maybe one of the reasons I write about Wyoming so much is that you're so overwhelmed by the landscape. And I was always interested in sort of small figures against a large landscape, and that's what I end up writing about. And the landscape, since you can't use the things that you'd use in, like, city fiction, and since there aren't that many other people around, you have to rely on other aspects of the world to evoke your character's mood and meaning and... So I use landscape a lot on that. So, yes, I am a landscape writer. I almost always start with a character, and then the world starts to build around them as I do the research, as I continue to write. In this book, the character of Gussie comes from somebody I didn't really know in Wyoming, but she lived in Du Bois, Wyoming, in the Wind River Valley. My parents had a ranch up there. I saw this man at the lower gate working on a windmill. I asked my mother later who was that man, and she said it was no man, it was Gussie Anderson, who later I found out in reading a town history had come into Wyoming from Colorado about the same time my character does, with a child in tow, although no one that I've talked to has ever heard of this child. That got me started on this character. She had worked men's jobs. She had worked road crew, as my character does. She had driven freight wagons over the passes in the days when you had 8 horses on a freight wagon. She was a pretty tough character. So I started with that idea that this woman came into Wyoming with a child in tow, and I wanted to figure out who she was and how she got there. So I had that basic thing to start with, and I had the dates. I followed the same dates as her life. From then, I had to go and look at what would it be like to work on a road crew then? What would these towns be like? What would the jobs be like? What was it like during World War I, which is when her child is born? What happened between World War I and World War II, which is when mostly she was raising her child in the Red Desert and up by the Sweetwater Mountains or Sweetwater River. So then the world begins to grow from that, and the more you research, the more things sort of stand out for you. You say, that would be interesting, and then the plot sort of grows out of the research, and it all sort of starts to go back and forth after that. One of the big fears, of course, writing a book like this is someone will read it and say, they didn't have electricity then, or that's not the name of that mountain. And so you spend a lot of time making sure that you have that stuff right. I didn't really, because I was working with a human being, you know, and she had certain wants and desires. But I did, as I was writing it, I have one person who reads my writing, a woman, and she would push me each chapter. She said, but what about the sexual nature of her? And for me, I had to be really careful about that because I wanted her to come across as an accurate portrayal. The hardest part was her giving birth and what it felt like after you give birth, because I hadn't ever given birth. And so everyone, of course, had their own story. Everyone who'd given birth said, it's like this, it's like this, it's like this. And so I'd had to sort of meld all those together. But generally speaking, someone asked me whether she took on a life of her own or where she came from or this and that. And I think, generally speaking, she just became more like me in sense of her desires and her understanding of the world. And I had to learn to become more like her in order to present her physical nature, which isn't a big part of the story, but I wanted to be as true as possible. One of the reasons I write longhand is that I'm very slow, and sitting perched at a computer is kind of uncomfortable. But plus, there's something to be said about the paper, the pen, the sort of slow process of letting things unravel. And you can take it with you wherever you want to go. You don't need a plug or a Wi-Fi. So I usually write a draft or two or three longhand, and then start typing things in, and then print them out and work again on the hard copy, usually rewrite it again like 12, 20 times, I don't know. But for me, there's something about holding that pen and going very slowly, and there's something for me that's wrong about looking at a screen where it's already looks like it's typeset and it's finished. And when it's handwritten, you know that it's just a draft. You know that it's going to have to be typed in, and even when you're typing it in, you can edit it. So I guess it's, you know, I guess different people work better different ways. I'm very slow, and slow does not work for typing. I was young. When I was an undergraduate, I wrote when I was in high school, you know, and I was sort of always going toward the English classes. And then when I was in college, I started writing poetry. And I wrote poetry for a couple years until I realized that it was next to impossible to write a good poem. So then, it's really hard. So then at the end of undergrad days, I switched over to fiction. And I wrote a story or two, and then I graduated. And then I thought I would go to graduate school in a year or so. But I didn't. And I ended up living on my parents' ranch in Wyoming by myself for a year, thinking, well, here I'll write, but I had nothing to write about. So I sort of went crazy. And then years later, when I went to graduate school, actually I was working in a very boring job, and a woman came by and said she had applied for graduate school in creative writing, and I said, oh yeah, I think I used to want to do that. So I thought, well, okay. So I asked her into my office, we talked about it. I had a year to get ready for graduate school to get some stories together. So that's really when I started writing seriously that year. And when I started writing, I ended up writing about, not about specifically my year on the ranch in Wyoming, but about that corner of Wyoming. And that ended up being basically my subject. So even though I went crazy, it paid off eventually. That's a funny story. Okay, I started with the first thing that I wrote for graduate school, and the first workshop that I was in, was quite a long short story. It was like 50 pages or something. And it took place in this town with the characters from my first novel. And so I handed it out, and everyone talked about it, and they talked about it as if it were the opening of a novel, maybe because it was so long, I don't know. Or maybe it had no end. So I was too embarrassed to say that it was a story. So that became my first novel, and then that's all I write is novels. I guess it taught me that I couldn't write a short story because the short stories were like 100 pages, so forget it. So I just keep going to 300, and then I'm done. Not that I've seen. actually, they do. In my first two novels didn't overlap in time period at all. They were like 100 years apart, more than that. So my characters couldn't interact. But with this book, which covers most of the 20th century, I was able to bring in the main character from the rest of the Earth and a slightly more minor character from Native. And they end up playing parts in this book. And I was always interested, especially with a character from the rest of the Earth. So we last saw him in 1872. I wondered what had happened to him. So that was a great pleasure to write that part and figure out what had happened to him over the years, see that he was okay or not. If anyone would like to hire me as a full-time writer, that would be fine. Yeah, there is a tension. For many years, I didn't teach because I was afraid that the energy that you need to focus on someone else's work is the same energy you need to focus on your own. But I've loved teaching here. You get a lot of energy back from the writers. And when I needed to finish my book, I just stopped teaching for a couple of months. So I'm hoping that I can figure out how to balance it so that it won't take me 7 or 8 years to write the next book. Yeah, I started one, but then it's kind of hard to work on it when you have a book coming out. So, but I did. I have gotten it started, but I can't tell you what it is. I don't look very much at the old stuff, and I don't have the feeling that I'd like to rewrite it or anything. It's just gone, you know. And I don't have time to read other novels. Like, I don't have time to read my own novels over and over. I'm not really interested in it. And I know that there are things, if I were to revisit them now, that I would do differently. I'm sure I've learned as a writer, but I just take it as part of the process. So, but I don't go back. I haven't reread my other novels since I published them. Probably the last time I read each of them was reading through the final proofs. Anything else? My books aren't very funny. But this is probably the funniest of them. I just don't feel comfortable. I mean, whatever sense of humor I have, if I have a sense of humor, isn't something that I can translate to the page. It's just based on making stupid quips, I think. And that doesn't really come off that well on the page. What was the question? Do I inject humor in it? This one, I actually, there are some scenes that are a little bit quirky. I guess they're funny, so I actually did try. But most of the time, if I try to actually write something funny, I end up cutting out all the funny stuff. So no. Sure. With my first two books, I didn't really have a process with my editor because they just took them as they were. This book, I sold the book based on half of the book. So I still had a half of the book to write. And I didn't have very much time to write it. I had about a year to write about 250 pages. So I wrote really, really fast, and I got it all together, and I sent it to him knowing that it wasn't done, but I wanted to get it to him on time. So then he just read it and wrote a long letter to me, and they were just very simple questions, like, I would like to know here such and such, or maybe we should have this filled in. And then I just rewrote it along those lines. I took another couple months and rewrote it, and then I sent it to him and said, what do you think? And he said, I don't have time to read it. I just trust you. Oh. So I'm not really sure if he's even read it. No, I think he might have. He's a guy from the West. He grew up around here. And he really seemed to know landscape. He knew what I was doing. And it was a good match, a really good match. And he asked just the right kinds of questions. I do tend to get caught up when I'm writing in the landscape and in the music of it all, and maybe I'm a little less sure of just making sure that people have their questions answered, and that's really what we worked on mostly. It didn't actually change any of the chapters or any of the basic action. He just wanted things answered. So I would add some flashbacks or some more, or clear up things that were there. So I never felt that he was trying to change the book at all. He was just trying to make it more clear. That's for everything. She's a poet. She's very smart. She's a wonderful writer. And she knows my sources. She knows Whitman. And she knows women, so that she was a good reader for this book. She'll just push me. I'll just send her something, and I'll think it's sort of done. And then she'll just say a few things. Once she said, I sent her a chapter, and she said, you know what Virginia Woolf does at the beginning of To the Lighthouse? Yeah. Well, do that. And I said, thanks a lot. And but she's a poet, and she just pushes me, you know, that way. She just knows I can do better. So generally, not too much line for line things, just a general sense that you can push it farther. And it's always good to have somebody like that. You don't want someone who says, oh, fine, I just want this, I just want that. You want someone who'll say, this isn't Woolf yet. It's not done. Are we done? Well, thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for John Perkins, Rick Riley, Nando Parado, Augustine Burroughs, Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Strout, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on April 25th, 2006.